Chapter 3. Her heart gave a startled plunge, but she continued to hold him back contemptuously. "Elle, I guess you made a mistake then. This ain't your wife's room any longer." She was not frightened, she simply felt a deep disgust, and perhaps he divined it, or read it in her face, for after staring at her a moment he drew back, and turned slowly away from the door. With her ear to her keyhole she heard him feel his way down the dark stairs, and toward the kitchen, and she listened for the crash of the cupboard panel, but instead she heard him, after an interval, unlock the door of the house, and his heavy steps came to her through the silence as he walked down the path. She crept to the window and saw his bent figure striding up the road in the moonlight. Then a belated sense of fear came to her with the consciousness of victory, and she slipped into bed, cold to the bone. A day or two later, poor Eudora Skeff, who for 20 years had been the custodian of the Hatchard Library, died suddenly of pneumonia, and the day after the funeral Charity went to see Miss Hatchard, and asked to be appointed librarian. The request seemed to surprise Miss Hatchard. She evidently questioned the new candidate's qualifications. "Why, I don't know, my dear. Aren't you rather too young?" she hesitated. "I want to earn some money," Charity merely answered. "Doesn't Mr. Royle give you all you require? No one is rich in North Dormer." "I want to earn money enough to get away." "To get away?" Miss Hatchard's puzzled wrinkles deepened, and there was a distressful pause. "You want to leave Mr. Royle?"
"Yes.
Or I want another woman in the house with me," said Charity resolutely. Miss Hatchard clasped her nervous hands about the arms of her chair. Her eyes invoked the faded countenances on the wall, and after a faint cough of indecision she brought out, "The house works too hard for you, I suppose?" Charity's heart grew cold. She understood that Miss Hatchard had no help to give her, and that she would have to fight her way out of her difficulty alone. A deeper sense of isolation overcame her. She felt incalculably old. "He's got to be talked to like a baby," she thought, with a feeling of compassion for Miss Hatchard's long immaturity. "Yes, that's it," she said aloud. "He houseworks too hard for me. I've been coughing a good deal this fall." She noted the immediate effect of this suggestion. Miss Hatchard paled at the memory of poor Eudora's taking off, and promised to do what she could. But of course there were people she must consult. The clergyman, the selectman of North Dormer, and a distant Hatchard relative at Springfield. "If you'd only gone to school," she sighed. She followed Charity to the door, and there, in the security of the threshold, said with a glance of evasive appeal, "No, Mr. Royle is trying at times, but his wife bore with him, and you must always remember, Charity, that it was Mr. Royle who brought you down from the mountain." Charity went home, and opened the door of Mr. Royle's office. He was sitting there by the stove reading Daniel Webster's speeches. They had met at meals during the 5 days that had elapsed since he had come to her door, and as he had walked at his side at Eudora's funeral, but they had not spoken a word to each other. He glanced up in surprise as she entered, and she noticed that he was unshaved, and that he looked unusually old, but as he had always thought of him as an old man, the change in his appearance did not move her. She told him as he had been to see Miss Hatchard, and with what object. She saw that he was astonished, but he made no comment. "I told her the housework was too hard for me, and I wanted to earn the money to pay for a hired girl. But I ain't going to pay for her. You've got to. I want to have some money of my own." Mr. Royle's bushy black eyebrows were drawn together in a frown, and he sat drumming with ink-stained nails on the edge of his desk. "What do you want to earn money for?" he asked. "So's to get away when I want to." "Why do you want to get away?" Her contempt flashed out. "Oh, you suppose anybody'd stay at North Dormer if they could help it?" "You wouldn't, folks say." With lowered head he asked, "Here'd you go to?" "Anywhere where I can earn my living. I'll try here first, and if I can't do it here, I'll go somewhere else. I'll go up the mountain, if I have to. She paused on this threat, and saw that it had taken effect. One, you should get Miss Hatcher and the selectman to take me at the library. And I want a woman here in the house with me, she repeated. Mr. Royal had grown exceedingly pale. When she ended, he stood up ponderously, leaning against the desk, and for a second or two they looked at each other. See here, he said at length, as though utterance were difficult, there's something I've been wanting to say to you. I ought to have said it before. I want you to marry me. The girl still stared at him without moving. Want you to marry me, he repeated, clearing his throat. The minister'll be up here next Sunday and we can fix it up then. Or I'll drive you down to Hepburn to the justice, and get it done there. I'll do whatever you say. His eyes fell under the merciless stare she continued to fix on him, and he shifted his weight uneasily from one foot to the other. As he stood there before her, unwieldy, shabby, disordered, the purple veins distorting the hands he pressed against the desk, and his long orator's jaw trembling with the effort of his avowal, he seemed like a hideous parody of the fatherly old man as he had always known. Marry you? Me? She burst out with a scornful laugh. Was that what you came to ask me the other night? What's come over you, I wonder? How long is it since you've looked at yourself in the glass? She straightened herself, insolently conscious of her youth and strength. Suppose you think it would be cheaper to marry me than to keep a hired girl. Everybody knows you're the closest man in Eagle County, but I guess you're not going to get your mending done for you that way twice. Mr. Royal did not move while she spoke. His face was ash-colored and his black eyebrows quivered, as though the blaze of her scorn had blinded him. When she ceased, he held up his hand. That'll do, that'll about do, he said. He turned to the door, and took his hat from the hat peg. On the threshold he paused. Eopal ain't been fair to me from the first, they ain't been fair to me, he said. Then he went out. A few days later, North Dormer learned with surprise that Charity had been appointed librarian of the Hatchard Memorial at a salary of $8 a month, and that old Verena Marsh, from the Creston Almshouse, was coming to live at Lawyer Royal's and do the cooking. 3. It was not in the room known at the Red House as Mr. Royal's Fice that he received his infrequent clients. Professional dignity and masculine independence made it necessary that he should have a real office, under a different roof, and his standing as the only lawyer of North Dormer required that the roof should be the same as that which sheltered the town hall and the post office. It was his habit to walk to this office twice a day, morning and afternoon. It was on the ground floor of the building, with a separate entrance and a weathered nameplate on the door. Before going in, he stepped into the post office for his mail, usually an empty ceremony, said a word or two to the town clerk, who sat across the passage in idle state, and then went over to the store on the opposite corner, where Carrick Fry, the storekeeper, always kept a chair for him, and where he was sure to find one or two selectmen leaning on the long counter, in an atmosphere of rope, leather, tar, and coffee beans. Mr. Royal, though monosyllabic at home, was not averse, in certain moods, to imparting his views to his fellow townsmen. Perhaps, also, he was unwilling that his rare clients should surprise him sitting, clerkless and unoccupied, in his moldy office. At any rate, his hours there were not much longer or more regular than Charity's at the library. The rest of the time he spent either at the store or in driving about the country on business connected with the insurance companies that he represented, or in sitting at home reading Bancroft's History of the United States and the speeches of Daniel Webster. Since the day when Charity had told him that she wished to succeed to Eudora Skeff's post, their relations had undefinably but definitely changed. Lawyer Royal had kept his word. He had obtained the place for her at the cost of considerable maneuvering, as she guessed from the number of rival candidates, and from the acerbity with which two of them, Orma Fry and the eldest target girl, treated her for nearly a year afterward. And he had engaged Verena Marsh, to come up from Creston and do the cooking. Verena was a poor old widow, doddering and shiftless. Charity suspected that she came for her keep. Mr. Royal was too close a man to give a dollar a day to a smart girl when he could get a deaf pauper for nothing. But at any rate, Verena was there, in the attic just over Charity, and the fact that she was deaf did not greatly trouble the young girl. Charity knew that what had happened on that hateful night would not happen again. She understood that, profoundly as he had despised Mr. Royal ever since, he despised himself still more profoundly. If he had asked for a woman in the house, it was far less for her own defense than for his humiliation. She needed no one to defend her. His humbled pride was her surest protection. He had never spoken a word of excuse or extenuation. The incident was as if it had never been. Yet its consequences were latent in every word that he and she exchanged, in every glance they instinctively turned from each other. Nothing now would ever shake her rule in the Red House. On the night of her meeting with Miss Hatchard's cousin, Charity lay in bed, her bare arms clasped under her rough head, and continued to think of him. She supposed that he meant to spend some time in North Dormer. He had said he was looking up the old houses in the neighborhood, and though she was not very clear as to his purpose, or as to why anyone should look for old houses when they lay in wait for one on every roadside, she understood that he needed the help of books, and resolved to hunt up the next day the volume he had failed to find, and any others that seemed related to the subject. Never had her ignorance of life and literature so weighed on her as in reliving the short scene of her discomfiture. "'Tis no use trying to be anything in this place," she muttered to her pillow, and she shriveled at the vision of vague metropolises, shining super Nettletons, where girls in better clothes than Belle Belches talked fluently of architecture to young men with hands like Lucius Harney's. Then she remembered his sudden pause when he had come close to the desk and had his first look at her. The sight had made him forget what he was going to say. She recalled the change in his face, and jumping up she ran over the bare boards to her washstand, found the matches, lit a candle, and lifted it to the square of looking glass on the whitewashed wall. Her small face, usually so darkly pale, glowed like a rose in the faint orb of light, and under her rumpled hair her eyes seemed deeper and larger than by day. Perhaps after all it was a mistake to wish they were blue. A clumsy band and button fastened her unbleached nightgown about the throat. She undid it, freed her thin shoulders, and saw herself a bride in low-neck satin, walking down an aisle with Lucius Harney. He would kiss her as they left the church. She put down the candle and covered her face with her hands, as if to imprison the kiss. At that moment she heard Mr. Royal's step as he came up the stairs to bed, and a fierce revulsion of feeling swept over her. Until then he had merely despised him, now deep hatred of him filled her heart. He became to her a horrible old man. The next day, when Mr. Royal came back to dinner, they faced each other in silence as usual. Verena's presence at the table was an excuse for their not talking, though her deafness would have permitted the freest interchange of confidences. But when the meal was over, and Mr. Royal rose from the table, he looked back at Charity, who had stayed to help the old woman clear away the dishes. "I want to speak to you a minute," he said, and she followed him across the passage, wondering. He seated himself in his black horsehair armchair, and she leaned against the window, indifferently. She was impatient to be gone to the library, to hunt for the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.